Imagine taking a toddler to see a highly anticipated Disney musical. You know, you're expecting a cozy afternoon of dancing penguins and like flying kites.
Right, just a nice, easy family outing.
Exactly. But then you get stopped at the theater doors by security, and the staff tells you point blank that the show is simply too terrifying for children under three.
Oh, wow. I mean, that just completely shatters the safety of the 1964 movie you probably grew up with, doesn't
It
it?
really does. And that is exactly what happened when the stage musical adaptation of Mary Poppins first opened its doors.
You know, the under three ban is, it's a detail that always stops people in their tracks. It signals immediately that we're not looking at a simple, you know, copy and paste translation of a cheerful movie onto a stage. We're looking at a theatrical landscape that actively decided to lean into the shadows and explore the real psychological weight of the original story.
Which is exactly what we are unpacking in today's deep dive. We're working from a really comprehensive encyclopedia entry today. It details the development, the global productions, the updated synopsis, and the rather drastic character adaptations of the Mary Poppins stage musical.
It's a fantastic source.
It is. And our mission today is to uncover how the creators manage this impossible balancing act. You know, bridging the gap between P.L. Travers's notoriously strict, genuinely dark original books and that candy-colored Disney film.
And somehow creating a global award-winning theatrical phenomenon in the process.
Exactly. And I promise you, by the end of this, the whimsical nanny in your head is going to be replaced by a story involving like demonic toy armies and a terrifying rival nanny known only as the Holy Terror.
Which is such a wild shift. But to understand how the musical became this unique, slightly menacing hybrid, we really have to look at the legal and creative stalemate that birthed it.
Right, because you cannot put on a show without the rights to the underlying intellectual property.
Exactly. And the original author, P.L. Travers, was fiercely, I mean, almost aggressively protective of her creation, largely because she famously despised the animated sequences and the much lighter tone of the Disney film.
Yeah, she was not a fan. So in 1993, the legendary theatrical producer Cameron Mackintosh actually met with Travers to acquire the stage rights. And she agreed, but she laid down some absolutely ironclad
She did
conditions.
not make it easy.
Not at all. She demanded that the creators of the stage production had to be entirely English. And much more significantly, she mandated that absolutely no one who had worked on the Disney film adaptation was allowed to be involved with the stage play in any capacity.
I mean, think about that. It was a contractual embargo against the very people who made the property a global sensation. But then, jump forward to 2001, and Mackintosh is opening talks with Thomas Schumacher, the head of Disney Theatrical Productions.
Okay, let's unpack this because it's like trying to bake a legendary cake where the recipe's creator demands you use zero sugar, but the bakery funding the whole operation is famous solely for their frosting.
That is a great way to put it.
Like, how do you reconcile a complete ban on Disney personnel with a necessary partnership with Disney? Because Disney owns the only engine the public actually wants to hear.
The iconic music.
The music written by the Sherman Brothers, they were locked in a stalemate where neither side had a complete vehicle.
Well, the diplomacy involved here is just a masterclass in theatrical producing. Mackintosh knew that staging a Mary Poppins musical without the Sherman Brothers songs, you know, without Chim Chim Cherry or Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, it would have completely alienated audiences.
Oh, people would have been furious. They'd feel cheated.
It's exactly. So the 2001 collaboration between Mackintosh and Disney allowed the stage play to pull off this miraculous fusion. They kept the beloved Disney music, but because of Travers's strict rules, Mackintosh was legally bound to build a completely new creative framework around it, using entirely new British talent.
Which is fascinating.
It really is. This forced them to honor Travers' original, more complex vision while still delivering the musical touchstones the public demanded.
And, you know, because Mackintosh was legally bound to use an all-British team that had never touched the Disney film, he couldn't rely on standard musical theater veterans who usually handle these massive corporate adaptations.
Right, the usual suspects were out.
So he needed a very specific type of creative team.
He needed people who could seamlessly integrate new material with some of the most famous songs of the 20th century. And this is where George Stiles and Anthony Drew enter the picture. They were an English songwriting duo who heard about the project and just decided to take a massive leap of faith. They independently wrote a demo version for a brand new introductory song for Mary, titled Practically Perfect.
They just wrote it on spec. I love that detail.
Right.
They weren't hired. They just essentially slid a demo tape across Cameron McIntosh's desk, hoping for the best. And it actually worked.
It worked because they mathematically reverse engineered the charm of the Sherman Brothers. They matched that specific Edwardian music hall pastiche.
So it sounded authentic.
Precisely. They ensured that when the show transitioned from a classic 1960s Disney song into a brand new 2000s stage song, the audience wouldn't feel the seams. And McIntosh had such a positive response to Practically Perfect that Styles and Drew were officially brought onto the creative team to provide additional music and lyrics.
But integrating the music is really only half the battle. They still needed someone to write the book, right? Like the actual script of the show.
Yes, the connective tissue.
And the producers chose Julian Fellowes. The encyclopedia notes this was specifically because of his clear understanding of the social niceties of the English class system that prevailed in the Edwardian era.
Which makes perfect sense when you think about it.
Well, here's where it gets really interesting for me. I mean, I have to push back on this a little. Julian Fellowes writes Downton Abbey.
He does.
He writes about stiff aristocrats drinking tea and arguing over inheritances. So putting him in charge of a flying magical nanny feels like a terrible mismatch. Doesn't it, bringing him in to write a magical children's musical risk, making it too stuffy and rigid? How did they justify that?
You know, it seems totally counterintuitive until you look at the mechanics of why the Banks family is falling apart in the first place. Fellowes was actually the perfect choice because he uses those rigid, suffocating social rules to ground the magic.
Okay, how so?
In this musical, the parents' dysfunction isn't just a silly plot device to get the nanny in the door. It is deeply rooted in very real Edwardian social pressures. George Banks is obsessed with order and his standing at the bank, while his wife Winifred is struggling to figure out her place in a society that demands absolute perfection.
Wait, so by making the Edwardian society the actual villain of the story, the magic stops being a party trick and becomes like a survival tool?
Precisely. Fellowes makes the societal stakes feel incredibly heavy. And because that reality is so oppressive, the Banks family's need for Mary Poppins feels significantly more urgent and authentic. The magic is a necessary release valve for a family suffocating under the weight of class expectations.
That is so smart. And that structural shift naturally leads to the changes they made to the kids on stage. Because the parents are suffocated and distracted, Jane and Michael Banks are out of control.
Oh, they are a nightmare.
They really are. They're not just delightfully precocious like in the movie. They are genuinely naughty.
The source material notes they are constantly answering back, fighting, and actively terrorizing their staff. This is why their previous nanny, Katie Nana, storms out at the very beginning of the show. She just leaves the cook and the houseboy complaining that they live in a literal madhouse.
And because the kids are genuine menaces, Mary Poppins has to be significantly tougher. Which brings us to a sequence in the first act that sparks that mild controversy and the toddler ban we talked about earlier.
Yes, the infamously scary scene.
It was originally titled Temper, Temper, and then it was later changed to Playing the Game. Basically, Jane and Michael get into a vicious physical fight over Jane's doll, Valentine. Mary Poppins orders them to bed, enchants them to sleep, and then the toys come alive.
And this is a sequence inspired directly by a chapter in Travers' books called Bad Wednesday. Valentine the doll and the rest of their disgruntled toys magically animate. They grow in size and aggressively surround the children to teach them a frightening lesson about how to take better care of their belongings.
If you're listening to this and thinking, wait, Mary Poppins essentially summons a demonic toy army.
Yes.
That is exactly what happened.
But it's genuinely unsettling.
It sounds less like a Jolly Holiday and more like a terrifying Stephen King novel or a horror movie where the porcelain dolls start moving in the dark. The theater staff literally had to stand at the doors and prevent patrons with toddlers from entering because this magical retribution was deemed too traumatizing.
It's a striking departure from the film, for sure. And it changes the mechanics of how magic functions in the story. You see this darker, more practical approach to magic applied to the classic songs, too.
Right.
Take a spoonful of sugar. In the film, Mary sings this right when she arrives to magically snap the nursery into a clean state. It's effortless. But in the stage musical, this song is moved to a completely different, much more chaotic scene.
Yeah, the scene where the children have inadvertently sabotaged the kitchen preparations for a highly important tea party Winifred is hosting. They have essentially destroyed the room.
Just absolute chaos.
Pots and pans everywhere. Ingredients smashed. It is a massive, tangible mess.
And when Mary uses a spoonful of sugar here, the underlying logic shifts. Why make the kids so disobedient and the magic so menacing? Ultimately, it serves the theatrical narrative better. By making the stakes real and the consequences frightening, Mary's interventions carry real weight.
It's not just a parlor trick anymore.
Exactly. The lesson of a spoonful of sugar is no longer about making a boring chore fun by snapping your fingers. It becomes a lesson in taking personal responsibility and actively working to fix the real messes you've made in your life.
And if the children are acting out this badly due to the parents' dysfunction, we have to look closely at the parents themselves. Digging into the encyclopedia entry's breakdown of the characters reveals that the real project of the stage musical isn't just fixing the kids.
No, not at all.
It is fixing the adults.
The character of Winifred Banks undergoes a massive rewrite to support this. In the film, she is a confident, somewhat distracted suffragette. On stage, that suffragette angle is completely gone.
Which is a huge change.
It is. She is now a former actress who gave up her career and is struggling desperately to fulfill her husband's rigid expectations of what an Edwardian society wife should be.
She is overwhelmed, confused, and feels like she is failing both her children and her husband. She is desperately trying to throw these smart key parties that no one actually attends.
It's really sad.
It is. She even gets a completely new song called Being Mrs. Banks to explore this exact anxiety. It is heartbreaking to watch her try to fit into a mold that wasn't made for her. We just impartially report what's in the text, but you can really see the social commentary fellows is weaving in there.
Oh, absolutely. But the most profound psychological shift in the entire production is reserved for George Banks. The musical vastly expands his role, revealing the mechanics of his coldness.
Why is he like this? Right.
Exactly. George is obsessed with order and lacks empathy because he had a deeply traumatizing childhood. He was ignored by his own parents, who didn't believe in public displays of affection, and he was raised by a cruel, fearsome nanny named Miss Andrew.
George refers to her as the Holy Terror, and the show draws a stark contrast between her and Mary Poppins. Where Mary advocates for a spoonful of sugar, Miss Andrew advocates for brimstone and treacle.
Which is such a fascinating historical detail to include. Brimstone is sulfur, and treacle is a sickly sweet syrup. Mixing them together was a genuine, rather brutal Victorian and Edwardian remedy forced upon children.
Ugh, that sounds awful.
It was essentially a punishment masquerading as medicine. It perfectly encapsulates Miss Andrew as a brutal tyrant who threatens to split the children up and send Michael away to a harsh boarding school.
And she doesn't just exist in George's memory either. In Act Two, Mary Poppins temporarily leaves the family to let them figure things out. And Winifred, in a misguided attempt to bring order back and please George, actually hires Miss Andrew to take over.
It's the worst possible move.
When George sees her, he is so terrified of his old childhood abuser that he literally flees his own house.
This sets up the climax of the second act, which is an epic nanny duel. Mary Poppins flies back in to save the day and confronts Miss Andrew.
I would pay so much money to see that duel.
It's incredible on stage. Mary ultimately gives Miss Andrew a taste of her own medicine, using magic to trap her inside a large bird cage and making her vanish down below the stage. It is an incredibly dramatic visual metaphor for conquering childhood demons.
So, what does this all mean? I mean, is the entire stage musical actually just a psychological intervention for George Banks, masquerading as a magical nanny story for the kids?
Yes. The structural changes made to the music heavily support that interpretation. The placement of the classic songs shifts the narrative weight entirely onto George's shoulders.
How so?
We'll take the song Let's Go Fly a Kite. In the film, that is the grand finale, sung by the whole family after George is saved. But in the musical, it is moved to the beginning of Act Two.
Oh, interesting. So Bert and the children sing it, giving Michael his dream of flying a kite with his father figure early on?
Exactly. And by moving that joy to the middle of the show, it leaves the actual finale wide open for George's specific redemption arc.
George's redemption in the musical is tied to a pivotal ethical choice he has to make at the bank, right?
Yes. He is presented with two investment options. One is an elaborate, highly sketchy money-making scheme from a man named Von Hustler. The other is a simple, honest factory project from a middle-class man named Northbrook.
And George remembers a question his daughter Jane asked him earlier. She asked, "Is a good man or a good idea more important?"
Such a great line.
Inspired by his family, George rejects the sketchy scheme and approves the good man's factory. But the immediate consequence is disastrous. He gets suspended without pay. He goes home thinking his life is completely ruined.
That leads to one of the most poignant moments in the show. At home, a family heirloom vase shatters, And inside the broken pieces, George finds gingerbread stars from his childhood.
Wow.
It sparks a profound moment of reflection about what actually matters in his life.
But then the bank calls him back. He assumes he is going to be officially fired and stripped of everything. Instead, the bank managers reveal that rejecting Von Hustler and backing Northbrook actually protected the bank from ruin and made them a fortune.
A total twist of fate.
The managers are stunned by his foresight, and they ask him what his secret word for success is.
And this is where the mechanics of the adaptation brilliantly tie everything together.
Mm.
George realizes that the bizarre nonsense word Mary Poppins taught the kids in the sweet shop, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, is the only answer.
Yes.
He says it to the furious bank chairman.
He essentially uses this ridiculous, joyful word to completely disarm the rigid Edwardian tension of the boardroom. He breaks the rules of his society, proving that humanity and joy actually make better business sense than cold calculation. He finally embraces the magic.
And Winifred arrives at the bank to defend him, showing she finally has the confidence to stand by his side as a true partner, regardless of his social standing. It brings George's arc to an incredibly triumphant close.
It's just so satisfying.
It really is. Mary Poppins realizes her task is done, the family is reunited, they're emotionally healthy, and she just flies away over the audience.
It was exactly this deeper psychological resonance, you know, this incredibly satisfying redemption of George Banks, that allowed the show to evolve past the beloved film and resonate globally as a theatrical masterpiece in its own right.
The critical and commercial response was staggering. It ran for over 3 years in the West End and then transferred to Broadway.
Yeah.
Where it ran for more than 6 years and over 2,600 performances.
It won Olivier Awards in London and Tony Awards in New York. And just to context set for you listening, those are the absolute highest honors in English-speaking theater. Bob Crowley won for his incredibly complex scenic design.
Which was so well-deserved.
Because when you think about it, he had to figure out the practical engineering of a magical house and a flying nanny for a live stage.
The stagecraft was a marvel. Crowley designed the Banks house to unfold like a massive multi-level dollhouse right in front of the audience's eyes. And for the finale, they developed a specialized flying harness system that allowed the actress playing Mary to physically fly out over the orchestra pit and up into the balconies of the theater.
The show has been seen by over 11 million people worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
It has been translated into 13 different languages, playing in countries as diverse as Sweden, Japan, and Hungary.
That is just a phenomenal reach.
It really is. That kind of global reach proves that the themes of family dysfunction, suffocating societal pressure, and ultimate redemption, they translate across all cultural boundaries.
It proves that the best adaptations don't just rely on nostalgia. If you're willing to dig into the darker, more complex corners of a classic story, you can reveal deeper psychological truths that resonate with us profoundly as adults.
Right.
It reminds us that we all have a bit of that Edwardian rigidity in us. You know, those expectations we place on ourselves and our families that do more harm than good.
That is the real magic of this deep dive. Adaptation isn't just about copying a story. It's about evolving it so it grows up alongside its audience. So as we wrap up today, I want to leave you with a thought to mull over. We all know the cozy image of the umbrella and the spoonful of sugar, but think about the other side of the coin. Think about George Banks running in terror from his childhood nanny. If Mary Poppins arrived at your house today, not to fix your kids, but to fix the brimstone and trickle from your own past, what room would she start cleaning first?